I also met with Dr. Tate Thigpen, and to begin, he commented on the Japanese study updated at ASCO looking at dose-dense carboplatin paclitaxel in the upfront setting.
In the frontline setting, just to set the stage, the current standard of care in ovarian cancer, as judged by the 24 cooperative groups worldwide that work with ovarian cancer at a consensus conference in June of 2010, is debulking surgery followed by chemotherapy, with what was judged by that particular group of people, the 24 groups, being as a minimum paclitaxel carboplatin every 3 weeks for 6 cycles. The caveat to that is that there are at least 3 other things you can do in initial therapy that are supported by at least 1 phase 3 trial, so that the consensus conference added these 3 things as potential options. You could opt to give the paclitaxel weekly and the carboplatin once every 3 weeks for those 6 cycles, for reasons we'll get into in just a moment. Or you could opt to use intraperitoneal therapy if the patient had small volume residual disease. Or you could add bevacizumab to the frontline chemotherapy. So those 3 options would be acceptable based on phase 3 trials. The particular abstract we want to look at that was presented at ASCO this year was actually a follow-up presentation of a Japanese study presented in 2008 and published in 2009 in The Lancet. This was a longer-term follow-up of the data. This study took 630 patients with advanced ovarian cancer and randomized them to get either every 3-week paclitaxel carboplatin, our standard therapy, for 6 cycles, or to get weekly paclitaxel plus every 3-week carboplatin for a total of 6 3-week cycles. And what their data as presented in 2008 showed was both a progression-free and overall survival advantage for the weekly paclitaxel regimen. Their follow-up data this time documented that advantage persists out much further than what their original report showed. And in fact, there is an absolute 7% survival advantage at the 3-year point for patients treated with the weekly regimen. This observation is being followed up in 3 other randomized trials, 1 in the U.S., which is complete with the data now maturing, and 2 in Europe that are completed with the data now maturing. So we'll have confirmation or refutation of the Japanese observations. The only caveat, if you intend to use the weekly paclitaxel plus every 3-week carboplatin in practice, is that, as given in the Japanese trial, it's a continuous 18 weeks of therapy with no break. That means you're going to see a good bit more neurotoxicity and a good bit more myelosuppression than you might actually anticipate.
We've gotten a little bit used to the issue of weekly paclitaxel in breast cancer, where it seems to be more effective. How do you approach it yourself in your own practice, and how do you see other people approaching it?
Well, we have, since, at least for ovarian cancer, we have used a good bit of the weekly paclitaxel plus every 3-week carboplatin since the presentation of the Japanese data in patients who don't qualify for trial. And we have seen exactly what was reported, that is more neurotoxicity than you would expect, more myelosuppression than you would expect. You can't tell from one person's personal experience whether there's an advantage or not. We're going to have to wait on the trials for that. One of those trials is a GOG trial here in the U.S. that is a large study that includes bevacizumab as a part of the 2 combinations that are being compared, with the variable being weekly versus every 3-week paclitaxel. So I think we're going to just have to wait and see. Right now, I would not call it the standard of care, but I would call it a reasonable option if you chose to do that instead of giving standard every 3-week paclitaxel carboplatin.
So what about the other issues you mentioned, bevacizumab, intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and other upfront issues? Any new data that's come out on these questions, and how do you approach it yourself, again, outside a trial setting?
Okay, there are relatively new data concerning the bevacizumab issue. There now have been 2 large randomized trials completed in the frontline setting involving over 3,300 patients. Both trials show a highly significant advantage in terms of progression-free survival for patients receiving bevacizumab followed by bevacizumab maintenance. Also, in the platinum-sensitive recurrent disease setting, there was a 3rd trial done involving almost 500 patients. And there you also saw a progression-free survival advantage. There was no documented overall survival advantage in any of those 3 trials, but I think we have to remember that ovarian cancer patients, when they relapse or when they progress, get 7 or 8 additional lines of therapy, all of which involve active agents, so that the survival endpoint becomes a very difficult endpoint and one that is plagued by a lot of other variables that are being thrown in by uncontrolled subsequent therapy. So progression-free survival to me is the best endpoint. It is clearly positive. The hazard ratios run somewhere in the vicinity of 0.7. That is a 30% reduction in the risk of progression. In my practice, if I have a patient who doesn't qualify for trial now, that patient gets bevacizumab as a part of her frontline therapy.
Any patients that you hold back on in terms of using bevacizumab? You know, there's been the issue of bowel perforation. Anything in terms of, you know, coexistent bowel problems that pushes you away from it?
Well, in the GOG trials, the first one was in patients that had one or two prior regimens, and the second was in a frontline setting. We saw no significant increase in bowel complications in the randomized trial, and in the phase two trial, in the second and third line setting, we didn't see any major bowel problems. The relatively significant incidence of bowel complications occurred in one trial that involved patients getting third, fourth, or fifth line therapy. So we've tended to avoid using bevacizumab in the patient who's had multiple prior lines of therapy. But in a patient who's had one, two, or three prior lines of therapy, I think that bevacizumab is relatively safe, with the only consistently elevated adverse effect being hypertension.
What about intraperitoneal therapy?
At our institution, we do intraperitoneal therapy on clinical trial. We have not used it extensively outside of clinical trial. The one part of the equation that was omitted from a lot of the press on intraperitoneal therapy in 2006, when the last GOG trial of IP therapy was presented, was the toxicity associated with IP therapy. It's a dramatic toxicity. Also, if you take the intraperitoneal therapy arm from that last trial and plot it on the same graph with the paclitaxel carboplatin survival curve from the previous GOG trial, they are almost identical. And you've got to remember that in the IP studies, paclitaxel cisplatin was the control arm. As a result, what the GOG has done is to do a fourth IP trial with paclitaxel carboplatin as the control arm, and looking at two IP regimens that hopefully will reduce the overall toxicity of the approach. But I would not want to give IP therapy to my mother or my wife if they had ovarian cancer because of the toxicity, unless we can demonstrate unequivocal survival advantages and toxicity that's tolerable. Now, there are others who would disagree with that and do use IP therapy outside of a clinical trial, so I don't want to portray that as the definitive opinion, but it's mine.
Any comments on where we are with PARP inhibitors? There was another study just reported at ASCO, randomized phase two, showing some encouraging results for laparib plus carbopaclitaxel for platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer.
These are patients who developed a complete response to frontline therapy and who went at least 6 months before any evidence of recurrence. These patients respond extremely well to repeat therapy with a platinum-based doublet, either paclitaxel, cisplatin, or carboplatin, or pegylated liposomal doxorubicin plus platinum, or gemcitabine plus platinum. What this study looked at was the addition of a PARP inhibitor to the chemotherapy, and then continuing the PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy in those patients who had at least stable disease after the six cycles of chemotherapy, and showed a significant advantage for the PARP inhibitor. Unlike breast cancer, where there have been some semi-disappointing results with PARP inhibitors, ovarian cancer appears to be very responsive to the use of PARP inhibitors. What we don't know for sure yet is which population of ovarian cancers is optimal for this. In this particular study, this was not a population that was selected for BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations, and only about 15% of the patients had the mutations on the trial. So it's clear that there are more patients than just the BRCA1 or BRCA2 patients who would be candidates for the use of PARP inhibitors, but how far that extends to the whole population is not clear. What you got to have to make a PARP inhibitor worthwhile using is some impairment of DNA repair by other mechanisms, because the PARP pathway in human cells is thought not to be very important unless there is impairment of DNA repair by other mechanisms. So we don't know how to define that overall population yet.
And people talked about BRCA-ness, and I guess, you know, responsiveness has been seen before this study, and now you have this study. Mm-hmm. Do you see PARP inhibitors in the near future coming into clinical practice in ovarian cancer?
That's going to depend on what the upcoming phase three trials show. This particular study was a randomized phase two. The GOG is right now working on developing a randomized phase three, and there are several other groups doing the same. And that's what's going to be required for any of the agents to ultimately be approved in ovarian cancer in the U.S. So right now, we don't have an approved PARP inhibitor that we can use outside a clinical trial.
Any comment on the new data from ASCO using bevacizumab in platinum-resistant disease?
Yeah, we talked earlier about bevacizumab in the frontline setting and in the platinum-sensitive setting. There was a trial in platinum-sensitive disease that showed that adding bevacizumab was beneficial. This particular study was called the AURELIA study. It was carried out in Europe. They took patients who had platinum-resistant recurrent disease and randomized them to chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab maintenance. And what they found was a significant progression-free survival advantage for the addition of the bevacizumab to the chemotherapy, which means that we have shown advantages for adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy in all three major settings, frontline, platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, and platinum-resistant recurrent disease. And there was a significant difference here, highly significant difference, so that it would appear that adding bevacizumab to chemotherapy in ovarian cancer yields substantial patient benefits.
Any novel agents or pathways that are being looked at in ovarian cancer that look encouraging to you?
Well, it's been interesting. We've looked at a wide variety of biological agents up to this point. The only one to this point that has shown a high order of activity has been bevacizumab. The mTOR inhibitors and the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, modest activity at best, not enough to prompt interest in pursuing it a lot further. Now, there are some small molecules that have anti-angiogenic effects that are being looked at. AMG 386 is being looked at in a phase 3 trial. Nintedanib or Vargatef is being looked at in a phase 3 trial. And there are some other trials also going forth with other small molecules. But to this point, I think in fairness, the only clearly active biological agent per se is bevacizumab, unless you count PARP inhibitors as a biological agent. And if you do, then there's evidence of some activity there too as well.
Anything else you can say about the BIBW compound?
Well, it has single agent activity. It has activity in combination with chemotherapy. And I know they have an ongoing phase 3 trial in the first line setting, and there are discussions about trials in the second line setting at the current time. That's about the extent of it. And the basis for that agent's activity is thought to be its anti-angiogenic effects.
Another multi-kinase TKI, huh?
Right. Mm-hmm.
How about if we sneak in a little bit of non-ovarian gynecologic cancer here? I'm curious what your thoughts are on the Japanese paper reported at ASCO on cervical cancer.
This is an interesting abstract because cervix cancer is one of those diseases where we've always contended that cisplatin is the better of the two platinum compounds. And that's based on data from the 1970s that suggested that cisplatin had a higher response rate in a whole series of phase 2 and phase 3 studies that were done in those days. There was never any direct comparison. This particular abstract is a study that directly compared paclitaxel carboplatin to paclitaxel cisplatin. In what was described as an equivalency study, it had only 300 and some odd patients, so it's relatively small for an equivalency study. But what they showed was that in cervix cancer, there was absolutely no difference in response rate, progression-free survival, and overall survival between paclitaxel carboplatin and paclitaxel cisplatin. And the investigators declared victory and said, well, paclitaxel carboplatin ought to be the treatment of choice. However, they did a subset analysis that had some very interesting findings. If you take those patients who have had prior exposure to cisplatin as a radiation sensitizer, which is the majority of the patients in the U.S. now, then in that group of patients, there's no difference between paclitaxel carboplatin and paclitaxel cisplatin. But if you take a patient who has either recurrent or disseminated disease and who has had no prior exposure to cisplatin, there was a statistically significant advantage for paclitaxel cisplatin. So that I think it's perfectly acceptable to use paclitaxel carboplatin as the frontline therapy for recurrent cervical cancer if they have been previously exposed to cisplatin as a radiation sensitizer. But if they're platinum naive, I would use the more toxic, more difficult to give cisplatin in preference because there appears to be an advantage.
How about the paper reported at SGO looking at endometrial cancer?
Yeah, endometrial cancer actually is a very interesting disease entity with regard to the use of systemic therapy. Prior to 2003, there were very few reports that were big enough to give meaningful data for the use of chemotherapy in endometrial cancer. But in 2003, the GOG presented two studies. First was looking at a three-drug combination of paclitaxel, doxorubicin, cisplatin, showing a major survival advantage over a doublet of doxorubicin and cisplatin. And for the first time, we had a regimen that we thought actually would give us not only a survival advantage, but some long-term survivors with metastatic or recurrent endometrial cancer. And at the same time, we also presented a trial that showed an advantage over radiotherapy for combination chemotherapy, doxorubicin, cisplatin, in patients with stage 3-4A disease, that is locally advanced disease. So from an evidence-based standard standpoint, the three-drug combination of paclitaxel, doxorubicin, cisplatin has been the evidence-based standard of care. But if you go out to the community and survey what's actually used, paclitaxel carboplatin has been actually used. Well, this study compared the three drugs to paclitaxel carboplatin directly in a study that involved 1,350 patients and shows absolutely no difference, total equivalence between paclitaxel carboplatin and the three-drug combination, which means we can use the easier-to-give, less toxic paclitaxel carboplatin and regard that as the standard of care for the treatment of recurrent or metastatic endometrial cancer.
So let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 64-year-old lady.
Okay, well, this case is actually not based off ASCO this year, but one study that was presented a couple of years ago at ASCO that's very important, that is widely known in the gynecology community, but not so widely known in the medical oncology community. So this is a 64-year-old lady who had stage 3C high-grade serous carcinoma, in other words, the most common form of the disease we have here in the U.S. She underwent an exploratory lap, had resection of all gross disease, so she was left with no gross disease at the end of the procedure, then received 6 cycles of paclitaxel carboplatin, ended that in a clinical complete remission, no evidence of disease. And now, some 10 months after completing that, she presents with a rising CA-125. She's had 3 successive rising monthly values of the CA-125 that's now at a level of 180, and she's asymptomatic and her CT scans are negative. And the question is, what do you do with this patient?
Another question might be, would you have drawn the CA-125s in the first place, I guess?
Well, that actually is an interesting question. I personally think you should, because what following the CA-125 allows you to do is to not do CT scans or anything until the appropriate time. And it's relatively cheap to get a CA-125. And then when the CA-125 starts rising, that's the trigger to start looking for evidence of recurrent disease. Well, in this patient's case, if you look at the British study, the proper approach here would be continued observation until she was symptomatic. What they did was to take patients who had completed initial therapy, were in a complete remission, and to get CA-125s every 3 months until the CA-125 value reached twice normal. At that point, they randomized the patient to either get their lab values or not get their lab values, which is why you could never have done this study in the United States. Those patients who got their lab values, almost all went immediately on treatment, all but 6 of them, about 500-plus patients in the randomized portion of the trial. And the other group that didn't get their values, of course, didn't get treated until they had other evidence of recurrent disease. And there was absolutely no difference in survival between the two groups. In fact, the only difference was in quality of life, the quality of life of the group that got their values and opted for immediate treatment actually had a deterioration in quality of life on average 3 months earlier than the other group. So very good and reasonable evidence that you shouldn't be treating just a rising marker in ovarian cancer. You should wait for other evidence of disease. But the CA-125 rising should be a trigger for when you start doing scans and other things to further evaluate the patient.
Just a related question, what do you see as the role of PET scanning in ovarian cancer?
Well, everybody uses PET scanning. Do we have hard data that PET scanning is an advantage? Not from any kind of randomized trial, but I think most people accept the value of PET scanning in ovarian cancer. The only caveat to that is that you do get false positives with PET scanning sometimes, and you can end up doing exploratory laparotomies on patients to evaluate the disease and find out that you don't actually have recurrent disease. So I think you have to interpret it in the context of all the other data that you have. But we use PET scanning in the follow-up on patients. For instance, when their CA-125 starts to rise, the standard thing we get is a PET scan, PET CT.
So what happened with this lady?
This particular patient is a patient that we had several years back. We followed her CA-125 until it reached 6,500. She started having symptoms at that point. We got a CAT scan and it showed gross disease. We treated her with paclitaxel carboplatin. She went back into a complete remission after two cycles, completed six cycles of therapy, and then went four more years before she relapsed again. Now, that's an anecdote, but I mean, the point is that there's no advantage to starting immediate treatment just because the CA-125 is rising.
I'm just curious how patients respond to this expectant management, including this particular lady.
Well, what I do when I have a patient with a rising CA-125 is I set aside an hour to talk with them and go over all of the data and explain to them the pros and cons of starting treatment. And we occasionally will have somebody who just demands immediate treatment, and we've done that. But most people, when given the full body of information, will opt for observation until there's more evidence of recurrence. But if you just try to run in and spend 2 minutes with a patient and run out, you're going to have an unhappy patient in many instances because they are so focused on the CA-125.
So this lady had this long response. What's her current situation?
She now is in her third complete remission from repeat treatment with a carboplatin-based doublet. Now, eventually, she will become platinum resistant and then eventually die of her disease. But she's done quite well now, is about total of about 9 years out from her initial diagnosis.
Has she ever gotten bevacizumab, and would you ever consider it for her in the future?
I would in a subsequent relapse. The downside with her is she will have had a fair amount of prior treatment. That probably, although not definitively, increases her risk of bowel complications. But yes, we would consider using bevacizumab. At the time that she got her last treatment with a doublet, which was about a year and a half ago, we didn't have the data from the bevacizumab studies at that point.
Any markers out there to help either select treatment or, you know, in addition to markers like CA-125 and other cancers, we're seeing a lot of biologic markers, even whole genome sequencing. Anything happening in ovarian cancer from that point of view?
Well, there are a lot of people looking at that. Nobody's been able to come up with a series of markers that gave us good predictive value and fully established the value of that set of markers. We also might add, this probably is a good point to mention too, that we don't have any overwhelming evidence that using any kind of in vitro test to test sensitivity has offered an advantage as yet. Everybody has their anecdote, but nobody has a randomized trial as of yet that shows an advantage for selection by biological testing, okay?
So how about your 61-year-old lady?
This patient is your standard frontline advanced ovarian cancer patient. She's 61 years old. She presented with increasing abdominal girth and discomfort, which turned out to be related to an advanced ovarian cancer with ascites. At initial presentation, she had a palpable 6-centimeter mass in the area of her left ovary. On CT scan, she had evidence of ascites and scattered masses throughout the abdomen. She was explored and debulked by a gynecologic oncologist successfully so that she had no gross disease remaining, which is what you want to achieve if you possibly can. And her CA-125 came down. She still has an elevated CA-125, but it's only 4 weeks after surgery, and it's coming down from the original 960. And the question was, what is the standard therapy for this patient?
What was this lady's lifestyle like? Was she working? What was her family situation?
Yeah, this particular patient was working, and in fact, continued to work through all of her treatment except for the postoperative recovery period.
Was she sort of out there on the internet trying to get information, or more just coming to you saying, what should I do?
Well, actually, before everything was finished, she was out there on the internet helping other people. She actually established a website at one point where she actually shared her experience with others and gave advice in the form of her own experience with the disease.
So what happened with this lady?
Well, now, she is now deceased. This story goes back about 15 years. But she actually experienced an initial complete remission, which was done outside of our institution. We were not using maintenance therapy in those days. That complete remission lasted 9 months. She relapsed. About that time, we got the results of the taxane study, and she came over to see us. So we retreated her with paclitaxel carboplatin and continued taxane maintenance for a planned 12 additional monthly cycles, as the study had done. She was still doing well at that point and refused to stop the paclitaxel. And so she actually continued to get monthly paclitaxel for 36 total cycles. Now, the significance of that is her second remission lasted 36 months. Her first remission lasted 9 months. It's unusual to see the second remission last longer than the first remission. Again, this is an anecdote, but I think it does suggest the value of extended taxane therapy, and there are studies that would support that. She, in total, had a total of 5 complete remissions from platinum-based therapy before she finally became platinum resistant. Received 3 additional lines of therapy with single agents in the platinum resistant setting with benefit, but finally became resistant to all of our available therapeutic armamentarium and did pass away. But the good she did in the time that she lived post her first relapse was absolutely amazing.
You mentioned that she, like most patients, presented with advanced disease. Anything new in terms of screening?
The short answer is no. But the longer answer is that there is one British study that holds out a little hope. They had 202,000 women that they randomized to either no screening or to screening, and then the screening group got sent to either transvaginal sonography screening or what they call multimodality screening, where they did CA125s, analyzed the results with an algorithm called the risk of ovarian cancer algorithm, and used that as a trigger for using color flow Doppler transvaginal sonography. The reported positive predictive value of that trial favoring the multimodality screening was 35%. That's by far the highest positive predictive value that we've seen and easily within the range that makes a good screening test. The caveat is we don't have any follow-up mortality data as of yet, and we would also need confirmation of those data since those data are somewhat at odds with other studies that have looked at transvaginal sonography and CA125. Other than that, I don't think that there is anything that is particularly promising on the horizon as a screening test in ovarian cancer.
How about your third patient, the 50-year-old woman?
Okay, well, this is an example of primary platinum-resistant disease. This is a 50-year-old lady who presented with stage 3C disease and an elevated CA125 of 305. She could not be adequately debulked, so she was at high risk from the get-go. She received frontline therapy consisting of 6 cycles of paclitaxel carboplatin, and at the end of that had stable disease with a CA125 that was still at a level of 200, and she did have abdominal discomfort. And the question here is, how would you approach this lady? Would you consider this lady for secondary debulking? The answer is not with what we have here as platinum-resistant disease, that is disease that did not respond to frontline therapy. If she had responded, had a complete remission and later relapsed and had just a solitary area or 1 or 2 areas of recurrent disease, debulking might benefit her. What she should receive is treatment with another active agent other than a platinum compound. And there are actually a list of 22 different drugs now that have activity in ovarian cancer as documented in phase 2 studies. So there are a lot of options out there. What most of us do is to use single agent chemotherapy. The main drugs that are used are either pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, topotecan, gemcitabine, weekly paclitaxel, or docetaxel. Those all are active approaches. We mentioned earlier that pemetrexed is active and could be used in that setting, as well as the other 16 compounds. So if a patient presents like this and has not responded to frontline therapy, they will benefit from a sequence of single agents, but they're not going to have the same level of benefit as would the patient who had responded to frontline therapy and then later relapsed, in other words, had platinum-sensitive recurrent disease. This is also the patient that if you wanted to use one of those in vitro assays to select which drug to use first, I would have no problem with that, although we don't have any evidence that that really is of benefit.
So you mentioned liposomal doxorubicin, and I saw a lot of excitement about that a couple of years ago with the, I think it was called the Calypso study, mm-hmm. But are you able to access it now?
Not currently, but there is an expectation that by the late fourth quarter of this year or the very early first quarter of 2013, there will be an adequate supply of pegylated liposomal doxorubicin to once again consider that as an option. Now, the FDA has allowed the import of what purports to be a similar compound at the current time. Frankly, we've not attempted to use that particular compound. I don't know how well tested it is. And also, we have a lot of other options that we can go to in the absence of a reliable supply of what we know has been extensively tested. You mentioned the Calypso trial. The Calypso trial was pegylated liposomal doxorubicin carboplatin versus paclitaxel carboplatin in the platinum-sensitive recurrent disease setting. And the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin carboplatin actually had a small progression-free survival advantage over the paclitaxel carboplatin in that trial, so that you could make the argument that in the platinum-sensitive recurrent disease setting, pegylated liposomal doxorubicin carboplatin might be your doublet of choice initially.
So what happened with this lady?
This lady got treated with four lines of single-agent therapy. She got pegylated liposomal doxorubicin first, which has been our standard first agent to use in this setting because it's once every 4 weeks, and we have folks driving in from 100 miles away out in the Mississippi Delta. And then topotecan, then gemcitabine, and then weekly paclitaxel. And then she had enough problems related to her disease that she did not want to continue therapy beyond that. Most patients will get five or six lines of therapy before they quit or before it's concluded that they will not benefit from further treatment.